Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:46 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is April 6th. It's a Thursday, but today I will do the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes as the UK bank holiday is going to be Friday and Monday, and I'll be taking those days off in observance of the holiday season. I thought I would kick off though and look at the Bank of Japan total assets. I think it's really quite interesting that when we look at this in local currency terms, then it dipped a bit in 2022 and then has rebounded over the course of the last 6 to 8 months. And it went up in a very profound manner for basically the last decade, and this is very much in line with Governor Kuroda's time at the Bank of Japan. So it then just begs the question, now that he's left, what's the most likely trajectory? Are we going to go back to a period like we had between 2000 and 2012 when the size of the balance sheet was largely irrelevant, or are we going to continue to see this trend continue? Now, of course, I think it is important to think about this not only in local currency terms, but on a constant currency basis. Because the strength of the dollar over the last 2 years represented a very significant contraction in liquidity in terms of the value of the assets sitting on the Bank of Japan's balance sheet. So we've had a meaningful rebound since the middle of 2022. It's now approaching the region of the 5-year moving average, 60 months, and this is a big question. Because when we look at Japan, well, it's been one of the primary providers of global liquidity, and this is the Deutsche Bank trade-weighted Japanese yen index. It's bouncing from the region of the 2007 low, and we don't get more back history than 2000, but this is an important area of potential support. So it does beg the question then, are we close to the end of the massive money printing associated with Kuroda's reign? Well, that I think is going to be very much dependent on what happens in terms of global inflation. The thing that has really been at the back of my mind for the last decade is, could Japan really have created an inflationary environment when we were in a disinflationary trend that started in 1980 for most of the rest of the world, and particularly the developed world? And I think that's a question that doesn't get nearly enough of play among economists or strategists. But it does, I think, highlight the fact that it is a globally oriented open economy, and all of that money that was printed in Japan, it wasn't locked inside Japan. There was a lot of leakage, and that funding went out into the wider world. It allowed the Japanese corporate sector to buy assets overseas. It allowed the proverbial Mrs. Watanabe to invest abroad. We're talking about trillions of dollars, upwards of $11 trillion. That have been created and found their way into asset prices all over the world. And what that also helped to do was both contain inflationary pressures at home, but then it also helps to insulate your regular Japanese investor or corporation from inflationary pressures because they've invested those assets abroad in income-producing investments, and then that has helped to supplement wages, even though wages in Japan have not gone up. If they really wanted to get inflation moving, they would basically have to do what the USA did during the pandemic, and that would be to literally give cash directly to workers. And just inflate demand in an artificial manner. And then, of course, that would put significant upward pressure on yields. And it does beg the question then, when are they going to abandon the yield curve control? And we've had a lot of movement in JGB yields. They contracted in the middle of March, and that was in direct response to stress in the global banking sector, not necessarily just the Japanese banking sector. And then subsequently, yields have rebounded back to test the horizon that the Bank of Japan has been defending around the 50 basis point level. In the event that Japan abandons its yield curve control program, then that's going to have a material impact on global liquidity because the Bank of Japan has been among the biggest providers of liquidity. And I think Japan is a perfect example of how capital is global and mobile, and money created in one location goes to the most attractive destination for those assets. And over the course of the last decade, when the Federal Reserve, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, China Central Bank were all active in inflating the size of their balance sheets, then the most attractive asset has been technology in the US markets. So the NASDAQ 100 went on an epic bull market for the last decade. And I think it's important to just highlight the fact that leveraged investors look at arithmetic scale. Unlevered investors generally tend to look at logarithmic scales. Any way one decides to cut it, then we've had a very clear acceleration in the period from the low in 2020 up to the peak at the beginning of 2022. So the acceleration is not as much as we had in the 1990s. And I think, but it is important to just keep an eye on this arithmetic scale chart. We've had a very clear acceleration. We've had a material pullback into the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and subsequently now it has rebounded. The primary way of thinking about the bull market since the financial crisis has been that it is liquidity fueled. So, the willingness of central banks to expand their balance sheets, to keep interest rates down for a prolonged period of time, provided a huge volume of fresh capital into the global markets and helped to inflate asset prices for just about everything. And we're not quite out of that yet, which is why asset prices are still well bid. And then, of course, there you have the technology trend. So, when we think about how are trends going to evolve, well, you have money supply and you have stories. So, the story over the last decade was captured by the trend of the autonomies, for example. We had the fact that oil prices were coming down and that the USA was turning into an energy exporter. So then that basically excised energy as a tax from our tax and consumption, and it helped to help growth take off and inflate asset prices. We had the trend of globalization, which improved efficiency, improved margins for globally oriented businesses, and then gave particular power to the largest companies. And Apple would be a great example of that being a mobile principality. All the products designed in California, manufactured wherever they can get the best manufacturing cost, then having their profits routed through the most attractive destination from a taxation perspective. So lots of companies fall into that exact same bracket. And these mobile principalities, they have been able to negotiate their way around a heavily globalized economy in a very, I think what we just might regard as an expert manner. But then, of course, we also had technological innovation. And chief among those, I think, over the last decade has been the evolution of 4G. So that provided mobile internet connectivity. It was the primary trend as well behind the evolution of the cloud, so that you had instant access to the internet wherever you are, and allowed for the number of internet connected devices to explode. Then that additionally fed a huge quantity of and volume of data, and now we have an additional growth in big data and in data analytics. And now what I think we can I think most accurately describe as the hype cycle in artificial intelligence. So the ease with which creation is taking place in the media sphere has is going to greatly increase the volume of media properties and various media products over the course of the next decade. And there will be new business models evolved from that. But the most important thing, of course, is that even though we have stories, the most important factor is that in order to drive a new thematic secular bull market, you also need liquidity. And that big question then is, are we going to continue to see the total assets of central banks continue to trend higher? Well, for the moment at least, they are still rebounding, and that is helping to support asset prices. And then we can think about what's happening in the broader bond markets. We've had Japanese yields pushing back up because investors are still looking at the potential that Japan will continue to try and create an inflationary trend. But the total assets of central banks are also very heavily dependent on the dollar weakening for a clear uptrend. And I think this is also very important that the total assets of central banks contracted in 2022 and haven't really moved since October. So even though we've had a material decline in the dollar, and it peaked right around the time when the total assets of central banks bottomed and has subsequently contracted quite meaningfully and is now encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. The knock-on effect for the total assets of central banks has not moved all that much, which tells us then that the process of contraction in central bank balance sheets is still underway. There's been this clear willingness among investors to think that the jump in the size of the Fed's balance sheet in response to the banking stress in March was a return to quantitative easing. But from a technical perspective, that's not actually true. The money that was created was not going out to buy assets, but rather to supplement the value of balance sheets within the banking sector. It's not quite the same thing. And what we have subsequently seen is that the size of the balance sheet has now started to contract once more. So this, and the point that I was making in March was that there is a very clear possibility that what they were in fact doing was akin to what the Bank of England did with the pension crisis last year, which was that they flooded the banking sector, well, not the banking sector, the pension sector with liquidity to allow them to meet their margin calls. And then continued to raise rates. And even though the I think there's sort of a misperception that the absolute rate isn't all that high. But let's just remind ourselves that back in September of last year, the rate was at 2%, and now it's at 4.25%. So even though there was this massive problem with the pension system and margin calls in the order of hundreds of millions, and a loss that was reaching into several billion for the pension system, and money that had to be thrown into it, well, then the Bank of England kept raising rates. And basically, they forestalled an issue with the pension system and then just kept going to try and get inflationary pressures under control. And arguably, inflation isn't quite yet under control because the CPI is still around 10%. So, still very sharply negative real interest rates. And I think what they're basically betting is that the volume of mortgages that are going to reset into significantly higher interest rates this year is probably going to act as a deflationary factor all on its own, and that will help to moderate inflationary pressures at some stage. And I suspect then that the Bank of England is going to at least slow down, if not pause, in their interest rate hiking until they have some visibility on exactly what that is going to mean for the economy. And we have similar types of conversations going on in several countries where the bond market has already begun to price in the potential that the majority of central banks are pretty close to the peak of their interest rate hiking cycle. So we're starting to see that the 10-year yield is pulling back down through the 200-day moving average. And I bought the TLT ETF several months ago because I thought that it's inevitable that we're going to have a deflationary shock. But the reason that I think there's going to be a deflationary shock is based mostly in history and very much tied to previous bouts of quantitative tightening. And when we had the period of quantitative tightening for the Federal Reserve in 2019, what you initially saw was that bond yields go up. And that's because investors are worried that when the Federal Reserve is not going to be buying the bonds anymore, well, then there'll be a dearth of buyers and then yields would rise. And but then people start worrying about deflation, that if there isn't going to be the same kind of support coming from the central bank, then how could the economy possibly persist in a growth phase? And then we see yields coming down in a very meaningful manner. And of course, then we had the pandemic and yields collapsed. Well, at the quantitative tightening, and let's just put some dates on that to try and be accurate. But the quantitative tightening program basically started right around April of last year. So in April of last year, yields went up and went up a lot because of inflationary pressures, but also because the Federal Reserve was no longer buying. So in an environment where you lose your biggest buyer and investors are worried about inflation, then the long end of the curve adjusted exceptionally quickly. So we had an absolute surge in the bond markets. And the Federal Reserve is still reducing the size of their balance sheet, and they are still engaged in quantitative tightening, even though they had to temporarily inflate the size of the balance sheet in response to the collapse of several regional banks. Now it's quite likely that we are coming up towards the deflationary shock, And there was lots of economic statistics this week. So when we look then at, for example, continuing claims continue to rise. The initial jobless claims is also rising. Yesterday, we also had, or I guess on the 4th, we had the jolts. So the number of job openings is going down. And then we had the PMI coming in weaker. And then the change in employment was meaningfully lower. So let's put that together. There are fewer jobs being advertised. There are fewer people working or starting new jobs. And then the number of people who are signing on for their initial jobless benefits is rising. So that's pointing towards economic weakness. And I think this is also important that when we look at the trend of jobless claims, well, you don't get a recession without unemployment rising. So then the big question here is, we have certainly got evidence of tightening activity, and we have bond yields that are starting to come down, and then jobless claims are starting to rise. And the thing is, of course, you can't see it on this chart because the pandemic splurge was so high, but that's definitely an uptrend. It's broken the sequence of lower rally highs. Now let's just go backwards and look at what this looked like before the pandemic. So we had jobless levels coming down steadily and a very clear trend. And then there was a sequence of lower rally highs and it was broken. And that was around the 235,000 job level. Then we've had another meaningful contraction. Something I was talking about in the broadcast yesterday was the economic pendulum. So this, I think, is probably the easiest way to look at it, that we had a profound change in the economy in 2020, and the global economy ground to a halt. That has never happened before, even in wartime. And we had the number of people unemployed go from meaningless levels to serious percentages of the population. And that was a profound deflationary shock. And the response from central banks around the world, but most particularly in the USA and Europe, was to print extraordinary volumes of cash. And that represented a huge surge in demand by putting money directly into the hands of employees, whether that was in the form of direct payments by the government to employees in the USA, or guaranteeing wages for people in Europe without them actually having to do any work. The net effect was the same. It created a huge demand surge, and the global supply chain was in no way, shape, or form ready for that jump in demand. So then we saw shipping rates explode on the upside, and then inflation just took off everywhere. So we can look at, for example, the Baltic Dry Index, where the index went from about 500 to 5,500 in the space of about 18 months. So that's a really extraordinary move. And it, I think, is only mirrored by the jump that we had between 2005 and 2008. And that also collapsed back to those new lows. So now the big question for everyone is, having had a new inflationary shock, the question that everyone is asking is this a new trend? Is inflation permanent? And are we going to be in an environment similar to the 1970s? Well, the only way that this is going to be like the 1970s is that a recession is coming. And if the recession is met with massive monetary accommodation, and that accommodation stays in the market for too long, then it's going to create an additional inflationary trend, and then it's going to manifest itself in a lot more precautionary spending by consumers. And then you start seeing the wage price spiral because they will immediately start demanding higher wages. On the other hand, if in the upcoming recession, we get more modest money printing, and then that the pace with which it's removed is accelerated, then that could help to moderate inflationary pressures. So we're not going, it's very unlikely that inflation is going to be conquered in one go, but that we will go through a recession and that it will be then subsequently conquered later. Now that is points towards, and I do think that's the most likely scenario, but what it points towards is shorter cycles. It means that we'll have big bull and bear trends that last for about 18 months at a time instead of a decade at a time. Now that shorter cycles, that generally coincides with a secular bear market. And then defining a secular bear market as a generational long period of PE ratio contraction and rising dividend yields, which obviously then would mean that bond yields don't go all the way down to their lows, but rather that inflation is not vanquished, but does get a We get a deflationary shock, and inflation doesn't disappear but takes a back seat until that money printing starts to take effect. And then there's a somewhat lagged effect. So it could be 6 months after the money printing starts that we start to see inflationary pressures rising again. So this is obviously a difficult environment. Now, when we think about the S&P 500, it's also back above its 200-day moving average, and it has bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So we're still in a steady environment, and a lot of the profit erosion has already happened in 2022, and investors have been conditioned to buy the dip, and buying the dip is working. And when a strategy has been proven to work and is still working, well, then nobody's really going to question it. But we're still in an environment where liquidity is tightening. And I think it is worth just looking at some of the pre or the things that give us a lead indicator for recessions. So the yield curve spread is heavily inverted. But more to the point is that it has been inverted. The first inversion was a year ago. So it's been inverted for a sufficiently long time that it is now having a material impact on the ability of the banking sector to profit. And the 10-year minus the 3-month is at historic lows. And still or has not rebounded, I think it would be the more accurate way of saying that. And we have to go back to the early 1980s to see a time when this particular spread has been even more inverted. And that also coincided with a really quite profound recession. Now, the one thing that we know is that the yield curve inversion is a lead indicator, but that there are three specific phases to the inversion. So initially, markets cheer that there is an inverted yield curve because it's basically a reflection of the short end of the curve rising in response to rising interest rates to combat inflationary pressures. And back in 2005 and 6, well, we had lots of commodity price inflation. And we had surging energy prices, surging commodity or agricultural commodity prices as well. And that necessitated some action to get that under control. But then it put profound pressure on the highly levered residential real estate market, and then we had the credit crisis in response to that. Well, now we have a different kind of inflation. We have demand for wages have gone up, but now wage growth is starting to moderate. And then we're starting to see unemployment is starting to rise. Now, rising unemployment is also an indicator of economic stress, obviously, and it's a precondition for a recession. You can't have a recession without unemployment rising. Now, let's also look at the high yield market and the yield curve spread associated with it. And it doesn't generally go inverted, but it is still trending downwards. So that's a very clear indication that we're still in an environment where liquidity is tightening. Now, we can do the same thing and look at the Muni curve. So it's one thing to talk about a single point on the yield curve or a single relationship in the yield curve inverting. But when the Fed funds rate is above the 30-year, well, then we can conclude that we have a full inversion of the yield curve, or close to it. But then when we also have other kinds of bonds also becoming in an inverted yield curve scenario, so we have the Muni bond curve is also now inverted. These are ticking every possible box for a recession. So a recession is inevitable. And now we are starting to see stress in the banking sector. So banks can't make money in an inverted yield curve environment. So they might do lots of other things to try and make money, but their primary business of borrowing short and lending long doesn't work when you have an inverted yield curve. And banks are materially underperforming. The S&P 500 banks is down from 450 to 280 in the space of little more than a year. And then it's also, I think, particularly relevant that some of the money center banks are underperforming. So Bank of America is one of those big custodians and also a big deposit holder. And it's well, it is broken. It has broken downwards, and it has so far failed to rally in any material fashion. And the other, another big one, is Bank of New York Mellon, and that has a very similar pattern overall. Now, when these types of banks that are large deposit holders and then also custodians are in stress, well, this is the very definition of too big to fail. And when they are when they are underperforming like this, it generally is an indication that their businesses aren't doing very well. Now, in a bull market, because bull markets are driven by liquidity and banks are liquidity providers, well, they should do well. Or at least they should keep pace with the market in a bull market. But when they are underperforming the wider market, then that tells us that credit is becoming less available. Now let's think about the high yield market. So high yield spreads are above 500 basis points. And firmed yesterday from the 500 basis point level. Now, I think it's important to highlight that the times of stress in the high yield market generally occur when at the 500 basis point level has been exceeded. And obviously, the credit crisis was a bit of an anomaly, but I think it is relevant to highlight that the breakout from the base formation was really when it cruised through the 500 basis point level. And that was almost a year ahead of the big acceleration higher. So this is a potential issue here. Now, when we think about other portions of the debt markets, so let's think about the levered loan total return index, because it has held out longer than anything else, and it is at a new high. So leveraged loans have not experienced any kind of stress at all so far. And that is one of the detracting factors in saying that this is going to be a bull market or a bear market similar to what we had in 2008. Leverage on this occasion is not focused in the in credit derivatives, but it is focused in commercial real estate. So if we look at the commercial real estate on a global basis, then this fund is down 50% from its peak at the beginning of 2022. And I think this is very clearly one of the areas where there is a real problem. So if we think back to the crisis in 2008, it was because there were loans made to people that really shouldn't have been getting the loans. Then there were liar loans, so there was no documentation required, and people were just borrowing money left and right and speculating heavily in residential property. Well, now let's think about commercial real estate. Well, the one thing that was difficult in the bull market that really got going in 2010, where we started to see globally important companies breaking out to new all-time highs. Well, when you're trying to run a hedge fund or you're trying to hedge, then it's very difficult to hedge when everything's going up. So what happened was a lot of the hedge funds, they were losing money on their hedges. So and those hedges, they really highlighted that the hedges didn't work in 2008 because the non-correlated assets went down fastest, and there was a mark-to-market crisis. And then, of course, we had this decade of very low interest rates that just lasted and lasted and lasted. So what happened really was that a lot of the hedge funds, they decided that they would outsource their hedge books to Goldman Sachs. So Goldman Asset Management saw a huge infusion of capital, and we have to think then about what asset class in the alternative space is large enough to absorb that flow. And the only real answer is commercial real estate. So there were extraordinary sums paid for these towers in several cities around the world. And now with the work to home phenomenon, there a work from home phenomenon, there's a lot of them are empty. And then the big question is how long can that persist? There's a lot of debt needs to be refinanced over the course of the next year and next year. A lot of that is going to be commercial real estate. So there was definitely an effort to refinance during the pandemic, and that's one of the reasons why the leverage loan total return index is still at new highs, because some companies successfully refinanced. They don't have to worry about a maturity wall. But even with that bullish phenomenon, there are still between 150 and 200 billion that needs to be refinanced in corporate debt every month for the next 3 years. On top of that, you have a huge volume of commercial real estate that needs to be refinanced. So it is absolutely essential that the bond yields start to come back down. It's essential that an opportunity is afforded to these operations to refinance at attractive levels. After that hurdle has been overcome, well, then interest rates can go up again, because the next big hurdle won't occur until later in the decade. So that pretty much ensures that interest rates are going to be coming down over the course of the next year or 18 months. And that will be in response to weaker economic growth, higher unemployment, and that will help to compress bond yields. So then, of course, we're going to have the big question about inflationary pressures, because we've obviously had gold popping on the upside. So gold has jumped up to 2000. Now it's a bit overbought in the short term, so we might see some additional consolidation. And I'm willing to buy more if prices come down. But I felt like I needed to have a representative piece. And then silver has broken its sequence of lower rally highs, and it's even more overbought in the short term. Now, I think this is a direct response to the very real potential that the dollar is going to continue lower. Now, there is talk, and I do think it's only talk, at least for now, that the BRICS nations want to create their own alternative currency, and they're looking at potentially something akin to special drawing rights from the IMF. The Federal Reserve announced last month that they're going to be releasing their SWIFTer payments system in June or May or June. So that would probably provide a lot of the services that would be associated with a central bank digital currency without actually doing it. And that would help to speed up global transfers. Now, the question, of course, is what would that mean for Bitcoin? I regard Bitcoin more than anything else as a liquidity barometer. The fact that it has popped on the upside, jumping from 20 to almost 30,000 in the space of a month, that is a clear bet that inflationary pressures are going to be mitigated and that credit conditions are going to become easier. So I think that's, and of course, then we are also a year out from the next halving, and generally speaking, prices begin to, our investors begin to price that in about a year ahead of the actual event. So I think that is the primary reason why Bitcoin has also rebounded. But in the event that the Federal Reserve provides swifter transfers at a lower cost, that's going to rob the cryptocurrency sector generally of a lot of the impetus that it has. Now, that will, of course, be a sideshow relative to the desire for an alternative asset in the event that the dollar continues lower and inflationary pressures are not abated. But in the short term, at least, I think that we've seen a good sized rebound, and Bitcoin's probably not going to surge until we see, or until we're a lot closer to the halvening. Generally speaking, it doesn't generally rally until after the halvening, and that would take us into 2024. Now, of course, it is also worth highlighting that Bitcoin has tended to do best during these periods of massive money printing. So it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that the next time we see that will be a lot closer to one of those halving events. And that also I think is rather interesting that there's a 4-year cycle in terms of money printing and availability of credit. But of course, what it also then questions is how much credit will be made available. The entire bull market hypothesis, the driving factor behind the Nasdaq, is based upon the assumption that the next time they start increasing the size of the balance sheets, then the size of the balance sheet will go up at least 50%, if not double. And that would take the size of the Fed's balance sheet up to somewhere approaching 17 trillion. Now, when we look at the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index, it rebounded early, broke its sequence of lower valley highs in January, and then subsequently has rolled over this week. Now, the sequence of higher reaction lows since the low in October is still intact, and that 200-day moving average has started to turn upwards. But I think it's important just that that level holds. We've had a meaningful contraction. We had a huge acceleration. So there's a strong likelihood that the bull market itself is over. We've seen huge investment in new supply, and the global semiconductor industry tends to be highly cyclical. So you first get a shortage, then you get massive investment in new supply. That takes a while to come onto the market. When it does, it floods the market with new supply. Generally, right around the same time that a global recession starts, so then demand takes a hit at exactly the same time that supply increases. And then subsequently, you get a huge decline in the price of products, massive overstocking of inventory that needs to be liquidated, the price of the shares collapses. Now, that is exactly what happened in the late 1990s, where we had this huge Y2K related jump in demand. Well, that is not at all dissimilar to what we had in the period after the pandemic, where everybody upgraded and everyone needed to upgrade because of the trend of working from home and remote work generally. So that pulled forward the sales from years in the future. And now we're heading into a recession, so demand will also take a hit. Now, it's not like there aren't going to be demand drivers in the future, not least from duplication of manufacturing, but also from the military sector. So there will be a lot more of investment in those types of activity, but probably not before we see prices coming down again. And we've had a good size rebound, and it has unwound about half of the decline. So this is about where resistance is to be expected to be found, and it does look like that's what's happening. So I think that there are risks ahead of us, and I think that this is not a time for taking big risks. And when we see strong rallies that begin to lose momentum, it's a time for taking profits. Now, of course, there are bullish phenomena that are around. So obviously, gold popping on the upside is having a material impact on the gold mining sector, and oil prices popped on the upside. But I think that's more a reflection of global weakness than any other factor, because OPEC Plus are desperate to support prices. So they're voluntarily cutting supply to try and sustain prices around the $90 area, because they're worried about a falling demand environment, and they might have to cut more, because I think the bigger risk is to demand. It's not like there's any real shortage of supply. And this has been a decade where the energy sector has successfully or successively cut back on investing in new supply. It's not that there isn't new supply. There's plenty of oil offshore. There's plenty of oil in Venezuela. There's plenty of oil in Canada. But you need higher prices, and you need higher prices for longer to ensure that there is a willingness to go out and exploit it. And that's before anybody even begins to talk about the trend of renewable energy and the ambivalence of regulators to investing in fossil fuels at all. And I think that the trend of carbon emissions is politically supported. So every time prices come back, they rebound because there are politicians waiting in the wings to support the market. And they will reduce the supply of carbon emissions to support prices in order to act as a disincentive to invest in new fossil fuels. But what this also means is that it's creating a shortage. So we're going to have a deflationary environment in some parts of the market, but we could just as easily have a stagflationary environment because of higher energy prices holding out for longer. And the regulatory burden and inefficiencies contributing to higher costs overall, and the fact that the cost of living has risen considerably. When we think about the response to the global financial crisis, what basically happened was that the USA decided that they were going to print the currency necessary to avoid a depression. But that had two knock-on effects. The first was that it started off a trend of asset price inflation. So wages didn't go up, but the cost of everything else did. And what basically happened was living standards went down for a significant proportion of the population, and that contraction in living standards paid off the debts. But then what it also did was it shook the faith of the creditors of the USA in their willingness to support the purchasing power of the dollar. And since then, China has basically stopped buying bonds. Russia has gone a long way towards de-dollarizing. And after the invasion of Ukraine, they had their foreign currency reserves confiscated. So now that has alerted the rest of the world to the real risk of holding assets in dollars. So remedial action is absolutely necessary, but remedial action would require a huge cut in spending on the fiscal front in the USA, and it really doesn't look like there's a lot of tolerance or appetite for that in an environment where political populism is rising. So it, I think, is more likely than not that the dollar, which has long been in a 7-year bull bear cycle, goes up for 7 years, messes around for a while, and goes down for 7 years, and messes around for a while, and goes up for 7 years. Well, we're due a 7-year downtrend. And that suggests that inflation isn't going to be quite conquered soon, that we'll have inflation ebb and flow, but that the trend will be higher over time. And that really is similar to what happened in the 1970s. The revolt of OPEC Plus in curtailing supply is very similar to the oil embargo in the 1970s. Now, obviously not in scale, but in terms of the potential, is certainly something that is we need to be aware of. There is obviously the potential that the continued strength in agricultural commodity prices is going to contribute to lower standards of living more generally. So sugar prices have jumped higher and are trading in a very clear backwardation, where you have higher prices at the front end of the curve. and then Robusta Coffee, which is very dependent on Vietnam, has also popped on the upside in here. So it's coming back up to the upper side of its range. Then I've seen a lot of commentary about the rice market. You have basically people who don't understand Asian culture at all talking about the need to stop eating rice. But then technologically, there have been new varieties of rice provided that have that are completely perennial. And that is something that could have a material deflationary impact on the price. So one of the factors that was contributing to inflationary pressures was higher rice prices, but it does now look like it's rolling over. And that's a good news story. If sugar prices will roll over, that would be an additional good news story. And corn has at least eased back, but the DBA Agriculture Fund has been rallying. So there are still higher price pressures in the agriculture sector. But that won't last indefinitely if oil prices eventually do start to give in to falling demand. So we're in a difficult environment right now because tighter credit conditions would eventually have an impact on the commodity markets because demand will evaporate during a recession. And usually it's commodities peak last because they generally thrive at all the way through to the beginning of a recession. So the strength that we see right now is not particularly bullish when other sectors have already rolled over, particularly banks. It's generally the case that the major miners, for example, will persist and hold in the region of their highs for much longer than the wider market. But then they will roll over in a very profound manner during a recession. And Glencore has attempted to buy Teck Resources over the last week, and they don't have a lot of time to get it done. But the share has rebounded and is now testing the region of the 200-day moving average. The trend is no longer nearly as consistent. I think the big question is whether having suggested to Teck Resources that they spin off their coal assets, would then Glencore become a takeover candidate itself? And big mining mergers also tend to happen right at the top of the commodity cycle. So it's certainly a trend of news to pay attention to. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.